Om Parthaya Pratibodhikam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Katitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashajayinim Ambatvam Anusandhatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. It's the one, verse 15. Bahirantascha Bhutanam Bahirantascha Bhutanam Acharancharamevacha Sukshmatvatthadavignyayam Durastam chanti kechatat Bahihi antaha cha bhutanam acharam charam eva cha Sukshmatvat tat avignyayam durastam cha antike chatat. Bahihi means outside. Antaha means inside. So bahihi, antaha cha, inside and outside, or outside and inside. Bhutanam, for all beings, that which is both outside and inside. And acharam, charam eva cha, and that which is both moving, charam means moving, and not moving, moving and immobile. Acharam is immobile, not moving, not able to move, and charam moving. So, sukshmatvat, ted, that which is both inside and outside for all beings, and that which is immobile and moving also, that sukshmatvat, because of being subtle, that twat, usually you translate that twat, it's an abstract in the fifth case, because of being sukshma, because of being subtle, tat, that, avignayam, is not able to be known, cannot be objectified, avignayam. It says, and that, tat, at the very end, tet, that is durastam, that is the most far away. Dura means far away. That Brahman, we're talking about that Brahman, is far, far away, and antike, most near. It's both far away and most near. So, bahihi, inside and outside, for all beings, that which is both inside and outside. Inside and outside means what, in reference to what? So here, what they're talking about is from the standpoint of the deha, this body, I consider myself, coming to this knowledge, myself stops here at my skin. So everything outside of me, so this is me, all of this, everything outside of me, right? And everything inside, so the prana, the mind, etc., everything inside, everything outside, for all beings, that is Brahman. Everything inside, but everything outside also. Very interesting, because here, the ahankara, the I am this, stops here. It's not out here. But Brahman, the Atma, which is Brahman, is not only in here, inside of the body, it's also outside. But once I say that, the body is left out, because everything outside of the body, that is Brahman, and everything inside of the body, that is Brahman. So the prana, the antakarana, the prana, the mind, etc., that is Brahman. But then you might think that the body, what about the body? You know? So he says, charam and acharam. Charam means everything that moves, but what they mean here, charam moves and doesn't move. Move means move by volition. So my body moves by volition. The river doesn't move by volition. The tree doesn't move by volition. It may be growing and the wind is blowing, so the the leaves are blowing and all of that. So there's movement, but not by volition. For volition, all living beings, mosquitoes, Swamiji uses that example, mosquitoes, you know, all living beings that have some control, they have a sukshma sharira, those things all are Brahman. And then all of the things that don't move, the things that don't move are like a tree or like a river or like this table. Anything that's immobile or anything that does not have is not able to move by volition. So this covers really everything. Everything outside, everything inside, outside from reference to this body, outside and inside. And then everything that moves by volition and everything that doesn't move. So now the whole universe is covered, really. Everything that exists. Then he says, now, that all of that is Brahman. But because of being sukshma, because of being the most subtle sukshma, it is avijñāyam. It is not objectifiable. It's not something which can be known. So here, and this is the big problem, you know, because we can know only really what we can objectify. And if you look at the five elements and the elementals, we go from the most gross. This is kind of there's a certain order and beauty to the creation in terms of going from the most gross to the most subtle. Let me see if I can do this because it gets a little tongue-twisty a little bit. If I go to the most gross, which is earth, and any elemental from earth, it's considered the most gross because I can experience it through all five of my sense organs, including the sense of smell. I can see it, I can hear it, I can taste it, I can touch it, I can smell it. So all five sense organs are available for the perception of physical matter, of matter. If I go in one to water, you know, the next element in terms of being gross, I can't smell water. So I have four sense organs that can experience water, but the sense of smell, I'll be smelling earth that might be in water. Water itself has no scent. So it's a little less gross, and I only have four sense organs that are available to experience that. If I go in the next one level in terms of subtlety, I have fire. Fire you can't taste and you can't smell it, so now I only have three sense organs available for that. If I go in one more to air, I can't perceive, I can't taste, and I can't smell. So with air, you know, you can feel it, you know, but you don't see it. And so now air is more subtle. And now if I go into space I can't even feel. And so in fact, even when we think of a sense organ that can even perceive space, like all they can give us is hearing, in the sense that sound travels through space. So the guna of sound, of space, is considered to be sound, and I can hear that. But none of the other sense organs are available to it. And so space, in terms of the world, is considered the most subtle, more subtle, and each one pervades the other. Like space can pervades air, but air can pervade fire. Fire can pervade water. Water can pervade earth. You know, so it's just an interesting order there. But now space also, which is the most subtle, and pervades everything actually. You know, space, you know that even though you are experiencing objects in space, you know that the objects aren't affecting space. Space pervades all objects because it's the most subtle. But at least I have sensory perception that can give me the concept of space, even though I'm not seeing space. I still have the concept of dimension, and I can hear sound. But now, consciousness is more subtle than space, because consciousness itself illumines space. Existence, conscious being, illumines space. Space exists, right? So space enjoys existence. So you have being, which space enjoys, And space itself is pervaded to all of the others, so the existence is something which is pervasive to all of them, but which itself has no means of objectification. It is kind of the ground of being of all things. And from space on out, and everything that exists in it, even in terms of the mind, subtle space, everything is existing within that, right? But all of these things are objectifiable, and you have some sense perception able to objectify it in the physical world. But what is there to objectify being itself, or conscious being? That which is pervasive to everything. Just like space is pervasive to everything, but still we have a way of perceiving space. But consciousness is pervasive even to that. And being pervasive to everything, and itself more subtle than everything, what is the means of knowledge for that to be known? In a sense, the conscious being, so now in terms of our experience in the world, we can know and relate to and act upon anything in the world that we can objectify. We can have a relationship with it. Anything that can be objectified. But the consciousness itself can't be objectified. If it can't be objectified, and it is the most subtle, how can it be known? Right? Your nose, through your sense of smell, can only smell earth. Your sense of taste, only water. Your sense of sight, you know, only forms. You know, your sense of touch, you know, can, your sense of, how did I go through this? I don't want to go through this again. But your sense of touch, you know, can feel the air and be burned by the fire, you know, and cooled by the water, you know, and feel the earth. But what can it do about being? It can't reach out and feel some being, you know? And the same with sounds, the same with the sense of hearing. And all of our inference and all of the means of knowledge that we have really depend upon sense perception or upon objectification. Right? Any means of knowledge we have, it interacts with what we can objectify. But all of the means of knowledge that we have and everything that we can objectify is already pervaded and has for its very being consciousness, which itself can't be objectified, so therefore how can it be known? The only way, in fact, that conscious being itself can be known is because it is self-evident. There aren't any pramanas or any sense organs that can know it. The sense organs are limited, their epistemological limits exist with whatever can be objectified within the creation. All of the vrittis in the mind, any vritti, any thought modification of the mind, is going to be in a subtle form, or in a it's going to be in a subtle form, but they can be at the form of subtle elements or physical elements. Anything in your mind is going to have some form of nama-rupa, name and form, and it will be enjoying consciousness. The name and form is objectifiable, known, I can comment on it, I can describe it, but consciousness is the ground of being. It's that because of which it is known. So it's not that the mind can turn around and as a conscious being illumine consciousness. Right? All the vrittis can do is the vrittis can take any thought modification, and that thought modification, whatever it be, if it's the thought modification that's being given to you through sense perception, that thought modification is there as a vritti in the mind, which is enjoying such shit, conscious being. If it just happens to be an intellection or an imagination, you know, or a memory or an emotion, then that thought modification, again, is known because of conscious being. But what knows conscious being? Consciousness knows conscious being. If the mind itself is objectified and it itself is known, it can't turn around and know the knower as though it had a separate consciousness. So you say the mind has consciousness. You are the conscious being, and the mind also has consciousness, some different consciousness. So then we have two people inside. We have me, the conscious being, and the mind, which is a conscious being. And so this mind, the conscious being, is a knower using the sense organs. And whatever thoughts it has, it knows those thoughts. That's what we think. The mind knows all of you through use of the sense perception, and it has thoughts, and it knows those thoughts. So if we give knowership consciousness to the mind, then that conscious mind should be able to turn around, you know, and know me, as though the consciousness belongs to it. This is how thorough this anyonya adyasa, this mutual superimposition, is, because I take me, this me, to be a knower, because I take myself to be the mind, my being, the conscious being, the existent being that I am, to be the mind. And then what happens is that me, this mind, which exists in this body, so this mind-body, needs to know the self. This mind needs to know the self. So the knower now is still with the mind. And so let this conscious mind that is me have a meditative experience of the capital S self, so that it can know and become enlightened by knowing Brahman, the conscious being which is infinite. And so in this situation, the ahankara is still with the mind, because I take conscious being, myself, to belong to the mind, and that mind has to know me. But actually, it's not quite like that. What's being said here is the reason that your being, you know, is avijñāya, it can't be known, means it can't be known by the mind or the sense organs. It can't be known by the mind or the sense organs because it's not objectifiable. It is pervasive to the mind and the sense organs, and it is the consciousness and being which the mind and the conscious being which the mind and the sense organs enjoy. That's why when we analyze the vrittis in the mind, and any vrittis that are being brought in through the sense organs, what we find is every single vritti is known. Right? What you take to be a knower, what we give knowership to, that thing that we give knowership to, like all the thoughts in my mind, I am the knower, those things that we give knowership to are themselves known. That's why, to understand this, it's such a useful recognition to realize that there is nothing in your experience all the way to the Atma that is not known. There actually is not an experience of the knower. There's only an experience of the known. And the knower is a construct. The knower is something which I give knowership to my sense organs, for instance. From a certain perspective, rightly so, but it's not correct. I give knowership to my sense organs because the sense organs are instruments which are responsible for gaining a thought modification of whatever the sense organs are allowing in. My eyes are responsible. They're an instrument for allowing there to be a vritti of name of a form. My ears are an instrument for allowing the mind to have a thought modification of sound, or the combination of all of the sense organs coming in, as all of these instruments, all of this data is coming in, to give a thought modification to the mind. And whatever that thought modification is, as it takes form, it is known. Okay? So I will attribute knowership to the sense organs because they're responsible for my seeing. Okay? And then I'll attribute knowership to the vritti to the thought modification, because the thought modification is responsible for this thing to be known. If the vritti wasn't there, it wouldn't be known. And because the vritti enjoys consciousness, then I identify myself with the conscious aspect of the vritti, and I identify the same consciousness with the knownness of the objects in the vritti. Right? So any vritti, any thought modification, it enjoys name and form, whatever is the content, and it also enjoys consciousness. So the ahankar comes along and it says, you know, I am the one who is conscious of this name and form. I, the mind, am conscious of whatever the perception is. That's the mind talking. The mind says, I am the conscious being. And I, the conscious being, am the knower of whatever is in my mind, whatever thought, whatever emotion, whatever perception. You know? And I think of my sense organs as instruments of knowledge. I am a seer, I am a hearer. You know, because I take the sense organs and the mind, which is abiding in this knowledge in this body, as my instruments of knowledge. I, the mind, who has these sense organs who pervade this body, I, this body-mind complex, I become the knower. Because everything that is known is differentiated from me, who is the knower. And so usually this ahankar stops right at this body. You know, but if we go inward to the mind, you know, we can say all of this is external to me, and then internal to me is the prana, the sense organs, the body, the sense organs, the mind, all of these things. Internal, external, and outward, external and internal. Actually, both what is external and internal, both are Brahman, but this Brahman is not something which can be known. So now what happens, what has to happen here, is that as I recognize this world is known through my sense perception, the sense organs themselves are known, every thought in my mind is known, the Atma, me, I am also known. I never differentiate the knownness from those things which are objectified. The knownness actually stops in terms of this viveka. It stops at me. Everything is known, right? Everything is known, and that resolves into my own self, which is known. The difference is the knownness which I am is constant. The knownness of everything else comes and goes. Whatever is in the vritti, that is known, and the vritti also is known. The consciousness is the constant. Everything else is mitya. Everything else is mitya because all of it is known, but it's coming into knowledge and going out of knowledge. The conscious being, the conscious being, never varies in any way. So the thing is, I think of the mind, I think of my mind as something which is, which enjoys knowership, but if I analyze it, in the end, just like the sense organs and all the objects of knowledge, it is only known. And the knownness is something which is steady. The contents that are illumined go on changing. And so, if I were to turn the mind around to reveal myself, and it itself had knowership, it had its own consciousness, then we would have a conscious being aware of another conscious being. We'd have one conscious being illuminating another conscious being. But actually, what is happening, because we do turn the mind around in a sense, what happens is when we're doing meditation or when we're deeply relaxing the mind, which is meditation actually, if you know what you're doing, when we're deeply relaxing the mind, what is happening is that all of the data with Maya, all of the sensory data is relaxed so much that it's barely competing with, all of that data is barely competing with conscious being. When you relax the mind and don't let it take you on a ride, you just keep relaxing it and relaxing it and relaxing it, it also is disappearing. Right? It's becoming so thinned out. You relax your body so that any type of stress in the body is becoming thinned out. It's not calling your attention. Your sensory data is not calling your attention. It's being very diluted, very thinned out in terms of adding any experience just to your own presence. As you relax your mind and you let the mind, whatever thoughts are in the mind, you simply let them be. And if one is catching you and creating some stress, catchy, calling your attention, you just sit with that. You either suggest that it, you know, just to relax, you suggest it to relax, let it send it on another journey. You know, say if it's going on one of its riffs of being upset about this particular thing, you can say, just relax, you know, just relax. Or you can say, let's think about that differently. Just to kind of break the riff, you know, that it's so used to going on. Just to allow it to, just to break the knots. You're just relaxing the knots. So that they also are creating in any waves. And what's happening, it's almost as like you're clearing all of the activity away just from you. Because in the Satyam Mithya, really, the mithya has no being at all. Zero. Just like the pot has no being. And so all of the sensory data and all of this physical data that you're getting and all the emotional, mental data that's happening there, it really has no separate existence apart from you. And so in contemplation, when you just relax and let it dissipate, let all of these this perceptual data dissipate, so that it's really, you know, like if wafts or little whiffs of clouds are passing through the sky, they just don't make any difference. It's still a sunny day, you know. They're passing through, but it's a sunny day. It's when the clouds really start to collect and become rain clouds, you know, that they are creating some as though competition with the sun, if you're coming from the standpoint of the mind, right? If you're coming from the standpoint of the sun, there's no problem at all. It could care less whether there's whiffs of clouds or whether it's a big rainstorm. It's just illumining whatever is there. The sun has no problem. Your being has no problem. You're always exactly the same. But the thing is, the mind is capable of all kinds of stress. And the world is capable of just pouring in all kinds of data, you know, which is making the mind, which is upsetting the mind, you know, and getting the mind involved, you know. And say the mind gets too involved. It gets too involved, so you're creating a lot of pain for yourself. The mind, well, let me put it this way, the mind is creating a lot of pain for you. If you learn how to relax, deeply relax, deeply let go, you know, all of that dissipates. It dissipates because it's not real. It's not like a chair, you know, or a table that exists in objective reality. Your mind is subjective. This exists in objective reality. All of this exists in objective reality. Your mind is subjective, you know. It's subtle. And yet this subtle mind can create dreams, it can create nightmares, it can create horrendous daydreams, or very happy ones also, which I can enter into. And so like that here, in this physical reality, your mind can do all kinds of things that are not good for you. There, it can do things that take you on a nightmarish journey, but it doesn't have to. You can say to the mind, do you really want to go on that journey? Do you really want to think about this in this way? Now, if you have no knowledge, if you have no self-knowledge, your mind would say something like, I certainly do, because this person has hurt me or this situation, you know, the way this job is going, it's going to just destroy my life. On and on. We have all kinds of, you know, catastrophic scenarios. But if you have knowledge that is backing the statement, you know, like, why don't you just relax or think about this differently, you have a reason for saying that. And the reason is that there's so many reasons, and your whole knowledge comes in to support that statement. But one is, the source of your wholeness and fullness is not subject to change. It's your own being. And your mind has for itself your being. Just like the pot has for itself clay, the self of your mind is whole and complete. And yet your mind is creating a nightmare. Your mind is, let's put it like this, your mind is having a nightmare. It's having a nightmare. You need to wake it up. Yeah. Like when you're in a nightmare, sometimes a nightmare is scary enough that it will wake you up. But here, when your mind is having a nightmarish daydream or on a nightmarish riff, you need to tell it, you're having a nightmare. Wake up. You think about this differently. This isn't worth it. The pain that you're creating by your thinking, by the way you're thinking, is not worth it. Because all you have to do is relax and the whole thing will go away. This person that you have so much hatred for has caused you so much trouble. If you just relax, what happens is the image of this monstrous person simply dissipates. There's no problem. There's no real problem. But we create the problem. We have an excuse for creating the problem when we have no knowledge. But when we have knowledge, we have a reason to replace the thought, that riff, the negative riff. We have a reason to replace it because it's to nobody's advantage and it's not going to resolve in a happy ending. These riffs don't resolve in a happy ending. The ananda is already there, so it's simply not worth it to me. You understand? When you have knowledge, some of these things that the mind goes through, they're meaningless. They're not going to create shanti of any kind. You know, we just have to wait for them to go away. So you can wait for them to go away. You can wait for some person or some situation to change the riff. You know, or you can simply change it yourself by just simply, do you really want to think about this like this? Is it really worth it? Or you can even say, don't think. Stop this. Don't think. This is not helpful. Why are you thinking about this? You've seen Swamiji do this. I haven't always understood it, but I've seen it. I understand it now, but I've seen him, even for his students, he's as though saying, stop thinking. why are you thinking like this? For what? For what? It's such an amazing, it's a very beautiful thing as you start to understand all of this. So what he's saying here, this self, you know, once your self is known, the self is avijñāyam. It's something that can't be known as an object, but it can be known because it is you and you are the conscious being, because of which everything is known, right? It's avijñāyam. But because it's so subtle, we're only used to knowing things through our sense perception and through what's going on in our mind. We don't recognize the me that is self-evident. So he says, this you are durastham. You are so far away from yourself if you're not known. There's nothing farther away than Brahman for one who doesn't know Brahman. Because you're looking. As long as you're looking, you know, it couldn't be farther away. You're looking in the actual opposite direction of where you could possibly find it. You can look for millions of miles and millions of years. You'll never find it. Because you're looking. And yet it's antike. Antike means it is the most near for the one who knows. It's the most near for the one who knows because it is you. It's not most near like this shirt, this sweater is most near. It is the most near. There is nothing most near than that because it's your very being. You can't get most near, any closer than you. But this you that you are couldn't be farther away if you don't know. Because we're only used to knowing things through our sense organs. We only think about knowing something in terms of the objectifiable world. Between the thoughts and moods and emotions in our mind and everything that we perceive through our sense organs, we totally take for granted without one thought about it the self-evident nature of me, the one who is always there. We never have a thought about it. And there's a reason for it why we never have a thought about it. If the mind is the one who thinks, right? And the mind has usurped my being. That's why it doesn't think about it. It already has the answer. I am the conscious being. That's what the mind thinks. I am the conscious being. So why would it think about it? I'm the conscious being, and I'm unhappy, and I'm happy, and I'm agitated, and I'm smart, and I'm stupid, and I'm young, and I'm old, and I'm a woman, and I'm a man, whatever. Whatever the upadis are, that's what the mind takes itself to be. And so this is the anyonya adhyasa. Why shouldn't the mind, because of ajnanam, ignorance, why shouldn't it make that mistake? Because it always enjoys consciousness. It is conscious being. It's not even that it enjoys consciousness as though it's something else. Mithya, what is mithya, is not something else. Like the mithya pot, it isn't anything there. There's no way to categorize it. There's only clay there. You can't say there's clay in the pot. But there's the pot. That is mithya. So, of course, the mind says, I am a conscious being. Because it is nothing else but Brahman. It is nothing else but that conscious being. And yet, conscious from the standpoint of conscious being, there's only conscious being. It's from the standpoint of the mind. This is the satya-mitya relationship. But from the standpoint of the mind says, I am the conscious being. It is totally correct. Because there is nothing else but that conscious being. It just doesn't know that everything outside is the conscious being also. And everything inside is the conscious being, that there is nothing but conscious being. That everything that moves, everything that has volition, is conscious being. Everything that is stationary, conscious being. Everything that is gross, everything that is subtle, inside, outside, conscious being. That it doesn't know. All it knows is, I am the conscious being. And you over there are conscious being. And you over there are conscious being. Because like me, you have sense organs and a mind. So you must be a conscious being like I'm a conscious being. And so whatever I think, whatever I do, that's me, the conscious being. And so why should it wonder about conscious being when it already has the answer? It doesn't wonder about it. And it takes this anyonya adhyasa, this superimposition, is its reality. You know, if you think about, you know, this red hot iron ball, the example that they use for a super mutual superimposition where the iron is hot and brilliant, you know, and the fire is heavy and round. If there was any sentience there, because the two are in the same place, the fire would be saying, yeah, you know, I'm round and heavy. That's my nature. You know? And, you know, this round, heavy being that I am is hot and brilliant. That's what I am. And so this is how the mind is. I am, you know, I am the conscious being. And I am sad or happy or dumb or stupid or whatever qualities I give to the mind. That is who I am. That's the anyonya adhyasa. But this is what we have to, this is what, and the commitment there is so thorough that to gain that viveka takes a lot of teaching, you know. And contemplation, you know, that contemplation is very, very helpful. But as your knowledge becomes firm, clear, as you gain clarity, what you notice happening to you are mental rifts that continue on. With all your inner child work and working on your complexes and all of this, you can still have mental rifts. Do you know what I mean? Way patterns of thinking that you get that are ingrained patterns of thinking. And then you feel, oh, I keep suffering these patterns of these thinking, you know. But at some point you have to realize, well, you really don't have to think that way. You don't have to think that way. Why don't you think about it differently? It's a very good exercise, just because, a couple of reasons. If your mind's on some sort of misery riff, one that's making you unhappy or hurting, and you suggest, wait, why don't you think about this differently? Or why don't you just let this type of thinking go? You may be able to do that, which is good. And you may not be able to do it, which is also interesting. If your mind says, no, I'm not going to stop thinking about this. This is important. Yeah, this is important, right? And you can, then there's some engagement there. You can say, well, why is it important? Why is it important? You know? And do a little bit of analysis there in light of your knowledge. You know? Who is it important to? And what is important? Is it important for me to get upset? Is that important? Is my suffering and creating suffering for myself and creating deep upset, why is that important? If you say, yes, that's important, why is it important? You know? They're very interesting questions. If the mind is tenacious about this type of thing and it doesn't just want to give up these riffs, I think at that time that's a good time to do inner child work. Because it means that there's too much unconscious hold on the material. That there's a little one inside that just does not want to give this up, and I'm not going to give it up. But that's a child. And then that's why we have to know all of these different levels of how to deal with the mind. Remember in the Bhagavad Gita, this beautiful verse in terms of kama, the different types of desires that you have that cause this raga dvesha and upsets to the mind. The simple ones are like, you can blow away just like the wind, you can just whisk them off. They are no problem. Some kind of thought or emotion comes through the mind, they're no problem at all. It's like a wispy cloud. It's nothing. There's nothing that's capturing you. You can just blow it away. If you need some words, you can just say, I'm not going there. But there's I'm not going there. I'm not going to think, well, I don't want to think like that. This isn't useful. It's gone. There's another level, you know, where the mind grabs you and starts taking you on a journey into sorrow, a journey into suffering. It's got you and it's doing that. But then you can, again, you can say, let's not go there. Let's think about this differently. If it's a person, you can say, don't go there with that person. Think about something good. Whatever it is that works. You can make it's almost like a sankalpa to not go that route. And see if your mind will agree to that. And often it will. Often these are things that you've never even tried. And that if you suggest, let's not think about that, in the light of your knowledge, your mind will say, right, that's right. And it won't. Yeah, because it'll realize there's a lot of knowledge involved in this stuff that I'm talking about now. But if your mind refuses and wants to take you on that path of suffering, then that's the time to go inside. That's the womb, you know, the fetus in the womb. It's no longer like the middle road is where you're having to kind of scrape the mirror, clean the mirror. It takes a little bit of effort, but not too much. You can still do it. You can redirect the mind. You can bring in your knowledge. You can, you know, change that type of habitual thinking. You can change it. But if you can't, then you need to go in and do the inner child work, you know, and kind of give those little ones some love. They don't want to change because they want to be loved and they want to be held. And nothing else is going to work. Like if you say, you know, just don't think that way, that's not useful for you. That's not enough, because what they want is to be loved, that's all. They don't want to be told what to do. You know, they need to be nurtured and loved. So then that's what you have to do. You have to be there and let those parts grow. That's the fetus in the womb. It takes some time. But you know what? We have to know all of these things, all of these different levels. Because your mind, because not everything that's going on for you is a fetus in the womb. A lot of the things are just things that they're just habitual. They're just habitual riffs, habitual ways of thinking about things that cause you and others pain. And you don't have to go there. And you can simply say, it's just a moment of consciousness. It gives you some space. Let's not go there. Let's think about this differently. And try thinking about it differently. Or this, it's almost, you know, like I brought in the Om, because we're doing the Mandukya. How that Om is loaded with the whole vision. You can have some ways of changing the flow of your thoughts. Like relax. Or we don't need to think about it like that. And these are just ideas, there's hundreds of them, whatever works for you. We don't need to think about it like that. Or think of something positive. Think of something positive. Don't go there. It's not worth it. You just say relax. All of that can be in just that one word. And your mind knows what it means. And then you'll think, yeah, why do I want to do that? It's just helping your mind, because you have countless beginningless lifetimes and all of this lifetime prior to knowledge to thinking in certain ways that are fine, and in other ways that are really pain-producing. Especially in all of the past things, all of the things that have come and have hurt you in one way or another. All of those kind of memories, we can have a lot of ways of thinking, hurtful ways of thinking around those past experiences. And they, the ones that are really bad, everybody has a handful of them at least, that are pretty bad, that have hurt you very much. And so there are patterns of thinking around those hurts that will keep playing themselves out. And you don't even really notice it. But once you do notice it, then you can say, let's not do that, let's not go there. And your mind will often say, oh, okay. You can even be surprised. I noticed that in myself before. I remember one time I had some pattern of thinking that was not good for me at all. And at one point I said, you know, let's not think about it like that, or something like that, I said. And my mind agreed. Oh, whoa. We learn these little things, you know. So if your mind agrees to one thing, you don't know how many things it's going to agree to. Some of them are just unconscious patterns that create pain. And if you notice, every time you notice a pattern of thinking that's creating pain, then that's a sadhana. And it's a sadhana either on the level of blowing it off, or on the level of the mirror that needs to be scrubbed, or on the level of a fetus in the womb, which requires a deeper level of a, you know, little child work and that type of thing. All three of them are sadhanas. It's just a way of of bringing the mind back home. And you have to remember that the mind is an instrument, and when it's not being used, it's just going on its own, unconsciously, basically. Just chattering away or doing whatever it's doing on its own. And so all kinds of unconscious material and things that haven't been dealt with are just naturally going to be coming up and floating away. And it doesn't make any difference if it's not causing you pain. But when it's causing you pain and taking you on a ride, that's the time to either blow it away, or talk to it, or do inner child work of some sort. See what I mean? So that your mind naturally enjoys the shanti that it deserves to, that it deserves to enjoy. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Sense from today that so self-knowledge comes from, you know, Shravanamanana and Nididhyasana, and the Nididhyasana is like relaxing the mind and some of its inner child. Maybe that's more preparatory, but you know, and like what we're talking about today, just bringing about shanti. And then there's a few practices like japa or shabda or those kinds of things. That there's no like direct way to the self. They're sort of indirect in a sense. It's all about shanti and then kind of giving reminders to the mind, and then somehow Brahman emerges from the background.
I would say like this. Like some of the contemplations I've been doing lately, to me they're all in a sense preparatory, and in one sense they're preparatory, but in another sense they're allowing you to sit with what is being taught at the time of teaching. Right, so say we do this very kind of deep relaxation, which is more of a satyam mitya type of meditation, where what we're doing is not doing any type of see or seen differentiation really. We're just totally relaxing so that we can see who is there, minus all of the agitation. But what makes that Nididhyasana is when I recognize that that one who is there is Brahman, is the conscious being that is really, the conscious being that is, from my own standpoint, the Atma, and which is the self of the creation. So I can be focusing on that conscious being just as the self, or I can be focusing on it as Ishwara, I can be focusing on it as Brahman, but it's that focus in the sense of that recognition that this conscious being that I am is Brahman, or is the Atma, which is Brahman. That's what makes it Nididhyasana. And all of the things like japa, pranayama, inner child work, doing very deep relaxation of the body and the mind. All of this is preparatory to bring the mind into a condition where that recognition is easy and natural. See what I mean? So say we do all of this relaxation, you know, we do inner child work, we do deep breathing, we do japa. What that does is bring the mind into a state of absorption, you know, where there's not a lot of mental activity and the mind has a feeling of absorption. And then we can introduce something like instead of doing the japa, we'll say, you know, I am consciousness, or I am Brahman, or I am Ishwara, which is just bringing the mind into focusing the mind on the reality of my own nature that is right there present without any of the superposition that is normally there. So in a way, Nididhyasana is a very slowed down shravana. You know, where you bring the mind into a state of absorption and then you're pointing out, you know, what at least should have been, is hopefully understood at the time of shravana. Now when you point it out, you know, the mind is sitting there in that and has a chance to just sit with it and appreciate it. Does that make sense?
It does, and it leaves, this is the same question I had last week. When does the difference between trying to do Nididhyasana versus actually doing it, and what I'm referring to is, well, say that you're saying I am the self. I mean, you can say that as a practice,
yeah.
Or I can say that as a practice, but that's different from actually knowing what that means and having that experience.
Well, I would say all of the teaching and all of the teaching methodology, the words that are being used, the Nididhyasana practice, are all directing the mind toward that, toward recognizing that, toward seeing it. But at some point you see it. Until that point takes place, then all of the teaching and everything, the Nididhyasana and all of the unfoldment, are just working with the mind to get it to recognize that. You know.
So in a sense, it's all preparation.
Well, it's...
Until the recognition is made.
I would say like this. Everything in the teaching is being used as a pramana to make you see. But you see when you see. You know, because there's different obstructions in the way. Just in your own thinking. And so, like, the teacher... Everybody has the... Say there's all these different teaching methodologies that are being used in different ways, in different orders, and in every class. Okay? But for your mind, and this is true for everybody, for your mind to really understand this, it first has to understand this. But before it can understand this, it needs to understand this. So it has its own order of obstructions. And that order, you know, has to be respected. And so even though one thing may be said, and somebody else will understand that because the obstructions to that one thing have already been cleared. But for you, you may not even hear it. Because there's too many other things that have to be understood before that thing is meaningful. And so, but the teaching circles around. It's not like the teaching is just linear and, oh boy, if you missed yesterday, you're finished, you know, because we're just moving on. It isn't like that at all. The prakriyas are circling around in all different kinds of order. And one thing clears up, and then another thing clears up, and then this thing clears up, and when one thing clears up, it clears up other things for you. You know, but then there's still a boulder somewhere, and you have to wait for that to get cleared up. And that gets cleared up, and it clears up everything, other things. Like that it goes. And there isn't just one order.
I was just going to ask that.
Everybody has their own unique individual order. And then, I mean, there's logical orders, but within the logical orders, there's differences, like that. You know, and then, I had something I was going to say, and I can't remember. It'll come back.
I really enjoy the distinction between space and consciousness, and I've understood that for a long time since some of your teachings a long time ago, but I have a really hard time describing it to other people. Like, my articulation of my understanding doesn't, like, so I have some sort of obstruction, I'm sure. But just to see if I'm beginning to be able to articulate it well. Is it fair to say that in space there's distance, and in consciousness there's no distance?
Well, that's true, in consciousness, because consciousness doesn't have any time or space, so it doesn't have any dimension.
Mm-hmm.
It's free of dimension, but it's one without a second, so there's nothing else. But that doesn't mean that it's big or small. These terms don't even apply. You know, there's a famous story that I think I've told it before, but I know Swamiji used to tell this story all the time. It's in one of the Upanishads, Brihadaranyaka, I think. The story goes like this. Maitreyi, or the wife of a rishi, one of the rishis, you know, wanted to gain knowledge, and
Gargi?
I don't know if this was Gargi. I don't remember, but anyway, let me tell the story, because I don't remember those details. I remember the story. She wanted to know the self, and so she asked her husband, who's a rishi. And maybe it was Gargi. Well, let's make it Gargi. He said, knowing that I might be wrong. He said, okay, where are you seated right now? She said, well, I'm seated here in front of the kutir. Well, where is the kutir? The kutir is here in Rishikesh. Oh, well, where is Rishikesh? Rishikesh is in India. But where is India? Well, India is on the earth. And where is the earth? Well, the earth is in space. So, well, where is space? And she thinks for a minute, she goes, well, space is in my mind. And then he goes, where is your mind? And then she was kind of stunned. She said, your mind is in consciousness. And then, where is consciousness? Well, is consciousness in my body? And where is your body? Well, your body is there, my body is there. You know, in front of the kutir. Where's the kutir? But in the end, the whole of space itself resolves in the mind, which resolves in consciousness. You know, I like that story. The most subtle. Consciousness is the most subtle. You know, and it's the one thing in which everything is contained.
Well, you know, when the mind says, I am consciousness, that's correct, isn't it?
It's correct, except it doesn't know that the consciousness is free of the mind. That's the understanding of Satyam Mithya. All of this is consciousness, but consciousness is free of all of this. You know?
And that's hard to say, you know, for the mind to say.
Well, the mind can say it once it understands. But see, the thing is, when the truth is that the mind is consciousness, is the conscious being, the mind is Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
This mind is Brahman.
Yeah.
You know, and so that means there is no separation at all. And so it has to, there's nothing to seek at all. There's nowhere to look, there's nothing to seek, there's only something to know. And what is to be known is the Satya Mitya, that the mind is consciousness and consciousness is free of the mind.
Mm.
That is the viveka.
Mm.
But that viveka is pretty tough, because the mind is certain that it is the conscious being, because it is the conscious being.
It almost demands, yeah. It demands to say, I am the conscious being. Yeah, and nothing else is a conscious being.
Because it is. But it doesn't realize the Satya Mitya. You know, and so then this conscious being, the conscious being which is the mind, is certainly not the Brahman that they're talking about. See, the conscious being which is the mind-body, which is me, that can't be Brahman because it's me. Me being this body, mind, sense organs. And so this is the viveka. That's why in the Katha Upanishad, they kind of talk about gaining this knowledge is like walking on the edge of a razor. And the Hamsa bird, you know, the Hamsa bird is pulling out milk from water. You know, because there's no separation. There's no separation between you and you're taking yourself to be a conscious being and the conscious being which you are, which is Brahman. So the thing is that you're so correct in your recognition of me that it's very difficult to make you understand, because the superimposition is so much. It's so total and so correct, 50% correct. From one standpoint, it's totally correct. And what that means is this very personal me that I already take to be me, the realization is that this me that I've always taken to be me, it is this me that is Brahman.
Not which, some is which is free of the mind and free of the body.
Yeah. The personal me that I take to be me right now, that me is Brahman. That's why doing a meditation where you just experience, relax your body, you know, so that it's not distracting you, you just relax it. And then you say, I am the body. Because you already know you're the body. So you say, I am the body, so that you can recognize who you are, the one who is really the self of the body. Because you already know that self. So you just say, okay, that's right, I am the body. So that you can recognize yourself. And then you have to hang on to that self that you've recognized as me, you know, and then move inward to I am the mind. Because you already know that self too. So the self which is the body is the self which is the mind. And you can say, I am the thought. You just keep moving in, you know. And then you focus just then on that me itself. Now you have the me there, and now you have to do a viveka between me and the things that are known, objectified, which is the mind and the body and the world. But at least you've captured me. You see what I mean? So these are all meditative, used in meditation especially, and in teaching, just to give the mind all these variety of opportunities to see what you're talking about.
I've just been wondering, I promised myself I would ask, there's certain words that never
work for you?
No, no.
Oh.
Certain that I've never noticed being said in all these years I've been going. Like one of them is love.
Uh-huh.
Another one is gratitude. These are all like big buzzwords in other areas. And then there was a third one, but I'm not quite sure I remember. But maybe just forgiveness. That's another one.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, are those, they're just not words that are in this.
Love is, and gratitude. I do use gratitude quite a bit in terms of an attitude toward your body and toward your mind when you're relaxing. Mm-hmm. So I do use gratitude quite a bit. I don't use forgiveness. Swamiji doesn't use that word either, because the word forgiveness is, what's the word? It's
sumptuous?
No, but kind of like that.
Arrogant?
Yeah, kind of like that. You know, it's
it assumes something.
It assumes something.
Okay,
instead of forgiveness, he always uses understanding. If you understand someone, you know, then that is...
You're still equal.
Yeah, if you really understand someone, then you don't need to forgive them. And forgiveness, it implies an inequality, like I'm better than you. So, but in understanding... When there's understanding, that there's no need for forgiveness. One psychologist who I was training under when I was becoming a psychologist said to me, you know, to be understood is to feel loved. If you feel somebody who really understands you, you feel loved. And I think that's what Swan, if you feel that somebody forgives you, that's, you don't really feel loved. It's kind of creepy.
Well, it's kind of like a debt.
Yeah, you're indebted and you deserve to be. I mean, the person has been so kind in forgiving you. You know, so there's something about it that is not very loving. Whereas understanding is loving, you know. And once in a while, when I'm doing a meditation, I'll use the word love, but it's not a word that I use very often. I use more ananda. The ananda, or the wholeness, or the fullness. But love would be okay to use. It's just it's such a conditioned word.
Yeah, a lot of those words.
Mm-hmm.
Like quite some time ago, I came to that understanding of forgiveness, that it can't be one so great and you're so bad, you know, that is then the true forgiveness. But that's another level, not the normal, what I first thought of as that word. Okay, thank you very much.
The word that I like instead of love, and I use this quite a bit, is that everyone wants to be loved. That's what we want. We want to be loved. And that being loved is a completed state. And being loved is actually the nature of the self. Nature of the self isn't loving or loved. It's a completed state of being loved. That's what we mean by wholeness. So there's a difference there between, and love is a good word, loving is a good word, but they're kind of verbal and love is abstract. And loving, I should be loving. Well, actually, if you feel loved, you're naturally loving. It's not an act, you know, it's not a verb. But I like the words being loved and saying that we all want to be loved, you know. I think that is true.
And you've talked about the self as the beloved.
And the beloved, yeah. The most loved. The beloved means the one who is loved.
Yeah.
So if you use it like that, then I think that's powerful.
Well, if you look at the self, it is, it has that loveness quality to it. You are being loved when you see that.
Well, that's true. That's true. Like when the mind is quiet, the mind feels loved. But that's because that's the completed state, the nature of the self. The self isn't being loved. That is its nature.
Mm.
Yeah. That's why the word beloved is nice. And commonly used also by different mystics in a different tradition. That complete beloved is that completed state. Yeah. Yeah.
Another word that works for me in the consideration of forgiveness is acceptance.
How do you mean?
I mean, like, I think of my father, my relationship with my father, and he, I'm so happy to have a good relationship with him now, but it hasn't always been easy. And I don't actually know that I understand his choices and his actions and his non-actions. I understand how he used or didn't use his free will. But I accept it now. I accept the humanness of him. I accept that I'm human. I have a lot of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Which resolves the difficulty.
Yeah.
And when I look at my relationship with my mother, I love her very much, but I don't have the same acceptance yet around her use or non-use of her free will. And I trust it'll come when the time is right, but I don't have the same acceptance with her yet. And so there's still a little bit of a rough spot.
Yeah.
But maybe more understanding with her. But anyways, I just wanted to throw in the word
acceptance. That's nice. It's almost, I love you like, I love you as you are. It's fine.
This is okay.
I love you just the way you are.
Mr. Rogers. I remember my 6-year-old watching Mr. Rogers sitting on his little chair, and she said, "He is so nice." And from the bottom of her heart, he is so nice.
Oh, that's so sweet. Oh, that's cute.
Well, it's like Tibby, you know, you learn to love her just the way she is.
Yeah.
Mice and all.
Huh? Nice bird, snakes.
Yeah, it's Tibby.
That's true, you know, that's one wonderful thing about animals and plants.
Yeah, they're not going to change.
And you give them, you know, just love them the way they are, you know, and you appreciate them so much and everything. With humans, it's a little harder. It'd be nice.
Well, why is that? I mean, you know, if you can do that with your little cat.
Well, they don't fight back in the same way.
And they don't have the same kind of free will. I mean, in a way they do, but not really.
It's not the same. Yeah, you know, they're much more. They're so natural, but they're also very, very loving. There's a certain unconditional quality to it. But at least with cats, cats are so free and they just basically do what they want. You know, but they're still very loving. You count on them.
Yeah, actually, like last night.
Strong guy Nellis said about animals. He says animals don't seem to care what anybody else thinks of them.
So much he said that.
Yeah.
That's oh, sweet. They're very soothing animals. That's why I always feel that anybody in a hospitals or rest homes or children, you know, who are in orphanages and that kind of thing, if they could have animals, they were allowed to have animals. And I think people do that too, but there's a lot of different organizations that do that, but they're just so naturally soothing.
They have those, what they call care animals.
Oh yeah, they do. They do.
Yeah, that they bring to the hospitals and nursing
homes. I know. I think it makes a big difference. It's because they...
Yeah, they give training to them.
Yeah, they train them, yeah. Because they have to have the basic stuff there, you know, it varies with the different dogs. And
mm-hmm. All right, let's stop.
Did you say that you were going to send us an email?
Yeah.
About, oh, okay.
I'm going to. I just forgot I have to do it. It's on my list.
Oh, yes. I hope to be
here. Hi, Susan. Hi, Jagadish. Yeah. Hi, Benny. Oh, hi, Barbara. Hi, Carl.
You know,
hi, John.
Say,
hi,
Theo.
Hi,
Dachin.
Hi, Nella.
Sure.
I'm going to be sending all of you an email.
He's Dutch.
And if you are using the Mac, then I'm going to ask you to write a note to the person that I give you the address to tell him what's wrong, why the Mac doesn't work very well. I'm talking with talking communities. So if you aren't using a Mac, then you can let me know.
Do you ever listen online? I used to, but it stopped working for me. So
yeah, it stopped working for a long time. A lot of people.
Love the Dutch. They still do.
Really? Oh, they do.
You're kidding.
When somebody's
welcome, Nella.
I was wondering if I could see you at some point after class, not tonight.
But yeah, sure.
Really do. Maybe on Sunday.
I don't think I have anything on Sunday. Well, maybe I'm remembering my mind. I don't really think so.
Interesting. Well,
just remind me on Sunday, but yeah, I think it's free. Okay, good. Yeah.
Because when you grew up, my